this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Browning and Joe Kirk. Hello.
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 This week's session was, I believe it's called It Takes Two, which just reminds me of Strictly that I'm forced to watch every week. But it is about organizations, relationships in terms of controllers, processes, and everything in between. So, yeah, it was, as someone put it, quite mind-boggling.
I know, it should be called It Takes At Least Two.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, you know what, I knew you was going to pick up on that at some point. But yeah, so we discussed, you know, a few case studies that we've been dealing with and trying to get to grips with internally at DPP, and maybe struggling with to some levels. And it was, you know, I really enjoyed the session. There was a lot of conversation around it.
We don't struggle with anything like that. What benefit we've got, Jasmine, is we've got a team of like 20 odd people,
yeah,
more than 20 yeah. people that we can set out a scenario and put it around a ton of, you know, privacy practitioners, and we can come up with a probably useful opinion.
Yeah, thank
but
God,
often,
though.
Well, yeah, often our colleagues, our privacy practitioners are on their own in their organisation,
yeah.
and they haven't really necessarily got any informed people to kick these things around at. That's why, I guess, why we've got, you know, a business and a community so people can reach out to each other and say, you know, I've got this complex scenario, cross-border, multinational corporation, complex processing. I've got to unravel it because I've got to get agreements in place. You know, some of it's joint controls, some of it's controls in common, some of it's independent controls, and some of it is processor. You know, some people, you know, you need help sometimes to sound out ideas. But that's what it was about, wasn't it? The essence of the session was about that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Like I was saying on the podcast, on the actual session, that this is one of the areas of data protection that I do struggle with because I don't get an immediate answer because there's so many variables that might affect the relationship. And, you know, it might not even just be one relationship between two parties or more than two parties. You know, it could be they could be joint controllership or control to processor. And, you know, that, like you say, Phil and Joe, that, you know, you do probably need to map it out most of the time to get to grips with it. But Joe, how did you find it?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I think it was probably, I don't want to say it was more informative than the other sessions, but it felt kind of more, a little bit more serious than some of our other sessions. But I don't necessarily think we gave an answer. I think we just kind of wanted to, you know, raise, as Phil said, the issue that some people may come across in trying to, you know, unravel what an organization is. And I think what also can be quite tricky is when an organization could be a controller for some aspects of process and activities, but then a processor in others, and there's a conflict, even though it's the same organization. And I think, Phil, you made a good point that you shouldn't necessarily come to the conclusion you're a controller.
Phil's waving just put Joe off.
No, I lost you there, Joe. I don't know if it was me that fell off or you fell off.
No,
you
find out
in
the recording. Waving at me. Because I'm quite things with my hands. I don't know if you thought I was waving at you as I was moving my hands. And then, yeah, you stumped me. Anyway, yeah, but I think in terms of determining the relationship between organisations, you shouldn't necessarily look at, you know, organization to organization. It should be kind of at a distinct level of the pros and activities that are going on in some instances, because that can make it a little bit easier.
Yes. Without further ado, then, on that note, thanks for summarizing that, Joe. We'll let you go into the main part of the session. We hope you enjoy it. Like we say, you know, we really get stuck into some intricate relationships and complex relationships, and you know, it's quite I think it's quite helpful to see that it can be complicated, and you know, on the face of it, it might not just be a controller processor relationship or whatnot, and you're not going crazy for getting confused and overthinking. There probably is,
yeah, I think what otherwise on as a topic is just so people who may be facing these challenges realize they're not alone.
Yeah, we are here for you.
No, everyone's got the same challenges, unraveling them quite tricky, you know.
Yeah.
maybe there's some food for thought in the session.
Yeah, thanks.
Some method in the madness.
Exactly. So we hope you enjoyed the session and thank you for listening. If you've got any issues with that or any opposing opinions, then let us know. We're all open ears. But for the time being, yeah, that's the approach that we're taking. Yeah, so how's your week been?
I honestly can't remember. Let me just my diary. What on earth I've been doing? Oh, I know what I've been doing. It's been quite interesting. I've been trying to write up my two audits from last week. So I went off and did a PCI audit, and that took me all day Monday and all morning on Tuesday to write up. And then I've been writing up the GDPR audit, which I did last week. But the thing is, you know, you're writing up the audit and then you need additional evidence. You ask a question, oh, have you got one of these policies or this type of register? And they go, oh, yeah, didn't we give you that? No. And then it all needs reviewing and forwarding in. So I'm with it probably 5 or 6 hours for finishing off that reporting draft and sending it to Joe to QA for me.
Well,
and then I'm preparing for next week's audit as well now as well. My next job is to prepare for next week's audit.
So many at the minute.
Yeah.
And Joe, you've been getting involved as well.
I have. That's what I've been doing this week. I've been prepping for next week's audit, and I'm actually leading the audit this time. The last two, I've been observing Phil and taking notes to the best of my abilities of what to do or what not to do. Is what Phil would say, not what I say. So yeah, that's my week's been kind of.
But it's gonna be good. That. Yeah, it's gonna be good, isn't it, next week? Because we're going off to do a local authority, and
yeah.
Again, I'm not sure how much involvement you've had with local authorities in terms of the posting activities, but it's vast, you know, what they do. I'm saying to Joe, you know, there's all the licensing of, you know, alcohol, you know, tattoo parlours. There's a whole food premises. There's a whole range of taxis. There's parking meters. There's a massive array of stuff that goes on. I mean, it's huge.
They do a lot. Yeah, when I was having a scan on the website, they had like a section of forms for people to, you know, submit for various, and there was 70 distinct forms for people to fill out for, as Phil says, you know, licensing, parkings, you know, tips and fly tip in and all sorts of stuff. So it's, yeah, it's going to be really intense to try and cover
ground. We're there for 2 days on site doing the on-site audit. And then, but I think it'll take a while to write up, Joe, because there'll be such a lot of, across such a broad range of stuff, and you're gonna have to try and, you know, step through it and draw conclusions of like, have they got this topic, this aspect of GDPR covered across the entirety of the operations? And you might find that some bits of it in some operations are, you know, able to demonstrate compliance, but in others they can't. So how we structure that report to give proper meaningful feedback and you know, highlight corrective actions to bring behavior into compliance and highlight recommendations is going to be really, you know, quite challenging, I think, for you.
I was going to say a nice little ease into audit, though.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and the two that we've had so far, Phil, one of them was a charity, wasn't it? And that was really quite complicated as well, the way they were structured in terms of, you know, I think it was a 25,000 distinct units under the associations.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been thrown in the deep end, to say the least.
People who are either aware of councils or work at councils are saying, cool, welcome to my world, Joe.
How many days have you got for the audit?
5 days, so right. A day prep that I've
a day on the privacy notices.
Yeah, I mean, they've got information asset registers, and they had 14 distinct documents. So I tried to populate that into one document, and Phil was like, put it all on one. And I started doing it, and I did about 3 or 4 of them, and it took me about 20 minutes because not one of them was like the same. And
I was that's thinking, the point. That's why you got to put it all on the one.
I know, but I was sat thinking, this, like, as good as this would be, you know, I've only got a day to kind of do the prep. This is wasted. So I did a bit of it, and I said, right, it's like that for 3 or 4, you know, I imagine it's going to be replicated throughout the rest of the
documents. So you can draw a conclusion. That the I think it's actually an information asset register. You know, what you'll find is departments have got it in different structures, therefore they've got different information, different quality of information in there, so there won't be enough consistency. You don't have to get it all into one sheet to see that, but it's an easy way to see it, and then you can filter it by that. Let's have a look at all the Article 6 lawful bases. But if they're all in the wrong columns, you've got a knife and fork that data about to get it into a usable format.
Yeah, so it's been fun.
We're looking forward to the 5:30 train, aren't we, Joe?
Yes, as always.
Don't envy you on that one.
Anyway, so next week, yeah, next week I'm doing the audit with Joe. Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm doing prep all day Monday for it. And then yeah. I'm actually off next Friday again.
Are you? Just again? Me and Jasmine then?
Yeah. Yeah, I am.
We'll get Case on it.
She's sat next to me. No. But yeah, she will. She'll be with us.
Yeah. So I've had a couple of weeks off the podcast, I think, anyway. It feels like it. So I've not really been keeping up to date before this week, really, on the news, but I can see that there's a few bits, especially that you found, Phil. Do you want to talk?
Yeah, the thing that will.
We'll get started.
The thing that caught my eye most, I think, I saw a couple of weeks ago. This is, you know, there was a school down in Stockport that are requiring pupils to wear lanyards with badges that highlight their learning difficulties. Now, the parents of the pupils are up in arms about this. It's a, you know, 12 year old, you know, secondary school type of thing. And you know, it's just, you know, it's obviously is probably to help, well, one would assume, to help the teachers identify the children with different learning difficulties. But why would you make it so public? Don't know. But I mean, that was interesting. I saw that on the BBC on the 4th of November. But the one that really caught my eye this week was a DocuSign exploit, which lets hackers send false invoices. Now, this is quite worrying, really. I mean, if you want, people want to see it, I'll put the link.
Yeah, the pizza's in. Overcooked. Those are the best bits that are left.
I'll put the link into the chat if people are interested in reading up about it. But the thing is that, you know, people are saying that DocuSign is a trusted app and it's not a malicious attachment or link. It's kind of like, you know, you're clicking through to the DocuSign or quasi-DocuSign platform and then you're going through the signing process. And so it's caught a lot of people out. So that was the one that I noticed. I thought, wow, that is worrying.
You know what, again, and I feel like I'm painting a bad name for myself, but I am impressed.
You know, what about Jasmine Harrison?
Oh, right.
These malactors, you know, they're just clever, and I can't help but admire it in some ways. You know, obviously, I do not condone this behaviour, but it is just, you know, it's intelligent, and obviously, you know, we need to be aware of this and enough
exactly.
to be able
stay
to.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I'm not going to give kudos, but
I'll put
moving
that,
on.
That's the link in there. It was in Forbes. Other things I'd seen, there's something about the ICO signing a joint statement with US authorities about data scraping. Again, that was quite interesting. You know, the statement, the ICO is saying that public personal information that is publicly accessible is still subject to data protection and privacy laws in most jurisdictions. Well, we kind of know that, don't we? You know, but there's a lot of people out there that think if it's out there in the public domain, it's fair game, don't they?
Yes.
So that was something I saw as well. There's a proposal under the Safer Phones Bill to raise the age of a kind of internet adulthood from 13 to 16 and require, you know, verified age verification for under 16s. Again, there's critics saying that's just going to stop young people from accessing useful services. It's going to, you know, stop them learning about the people that Jasmine admires and so on and so forth. Is this Lord David Holmes?
just see what you meant. So on that, actually, me and Joe were talking about it earlier, and there's, you know, there's some opposing arguments to raising the age, saying that, you know, it's taken away from children being able to navigate, you know, the online world and social media and whatnot to at an earlier age, to be able to, you know, learn and grow with that as they get older. So when they're exposed to this addictive content and whatever content that might include as well, that, you know, they're not equipped when they become of age. So I thought that was quite an interesting point, but I still don't think that it exceeds the importance of protecting children at a young age against, you know, such content. We were trying to figure out how, you know, how you might combat the problems faced by children being exposed to online content as it stands, and, you know, just how addictive it is in general, and, you know, algorithms and whatnot that draws you in so much. But it is so difficult, and I think it's probably worth looking at, you know, how other countries approach this. But I don't think there's a perfect answer, and I don't think it's something, after reading it this morning, that you can think of over a couple of hours. You know, I think this will take weeks of deep thought to get it right, really. David said Australian government is looking to pass legislation restricting and banning social media access to under 16s.
Right, yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
And Kate told me Florida as well earlier.
And his daughter was horrified.
Yeah, now one
but
thing
that that's a good point, Chris says, how do they verify age, you know? It's I was thinking, you know, if you get to the age of 18, it's quite standard that you're asked for your ID when you go out, or you might have your driver's license at 17, but that doesn't apply to all people. There still needs to be a way of checking.
There's age verification services that have established themselves, and so, you know, you would verify age using, kind of, you set up an age verification service, you verify the age of that other person, then everybody else verifies the age with your database. The problem is, if that age verification database got compromised, that would be a major problem. I mean, Joe and I had issues. When we went down to Kent, was it last week, week before last? They asked us for our driving licenses when we checked in. And I said, why? And the receptionist said, it's because if you damage the room, you know, we need to kind of know who you are. So theoretically, I haven't done it yet, Joe, but I said all right to them. Theoretically, as soon as we've checked out and the housekeeping have been in and said, oh, there's no damage in Phil's room, but Joe's trashed the place again. As long as there's been no damage, then they don't need my driving license, do they? So they could shred it. But why would they take a photocopy of it? Again, it's just increasing the risk. It's proliferating data. It's increasing the risk. You know, it was a tiny little hotel, privately owned thing, so not like a big chain. But even so, there's just this assumption that, you know, all your personal data, all your government IDs, we should have a copy of it. Why? Durham rock and roll lifestyle. Exactly. Exactly. You should have seen it. It wasn't... I had to apologise to Joe. Last time we went to a hotel, we were staying in this really swanky place in London. This time it was a bit downbeat, wasn't it?
Yeah, quite the difference between the two, but it's fine. The place to kip is all that matters.
Yeah. Anyway, how do we get on that subject? Now, another thing I saw in the news, which was very, I think, really interesting, is EU, right? So October the 4th, the Court of Justice of the European Union has passed a judgment. I'll put the case in the chat if anyone was interested. And basically, the key takeaway is that the Court of Justice of the European Union has said it won't rule out the possibility of a competitor of an organisation bringing a civil action before the courts on the basis of unfair commercial practices for non-compliance with the GDPR. Let me tell you that in a better way. So your competitor's ignoring the GDPR or the PECA, and you think, ah, that's unfair. Like they're ringing people up or emailing them. You know, we don't think they got their consents properly aligned. Well, that means you could bring into the civil courts an action for unfair competitive advantages for ignoring the law.
Wow.
Now, that I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
To think that through, yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah. It's a positive step as well, and it'll stop organisations looking at someone else's privacy notice and saying, oh, well, they do it, we should as well.
Yeah.
Because you see that all the time.
Yeah, taking it, you know, how you then deal with that, making it come to life, who knows, you know, and they haven't said this is actually going to happen. They said that they won't rule out the possibility. But again, I think fascinating to think that one through.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully, you know, give us a bit more... you know, more leverage internally.
I think that's quite good, but you not think organisations are probably going to start to just have a bit of a petty war between each other and just start reporting each other and sending each other to court? Because I imagine these cases aren't quick conclusions, and it's going to cost the organisation money, isn't it, I guess, to go to court. So do you not think
that's fair choice at the end of the day, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
maybe. Sorry, I don't really know how courts work. I've never been to one, never had to pay, but if I was to report my competitor to the courts and say that, you know, that the direct marketing without valid consent, then would the competitor have to pay the court fees of when they go to court?
Yeah, I think you pay your own costs, don't you? But they might award costs whoever wins. But it might be used for spoiling tactics, slowing people down, or highlighting the fact that you think there's a non-compliance going on. But all the more reason for getting your house in order and being able to show it's in order.
Yeah, I think that's really good as well for putting a bit less pressure on supervisory authorities to ensure that organisations are complying, because in some instances that is lacking anyway, and it just gives more support for the GDPR and compliance. I like it.
Yeah. So that was interesting. I don't know if you saw the company that in America that had the National Public Data, the Florida-based company, is now filing for bankruptcy. They had a big data breach, 272 million social security numbers got compromised, and 600 million phone numbers. There's a lot of lawsuits against them, and it's been enough to they're going basically. We talked the week before last about these posters, a fantastic poster the ICO's produced. I can't remember what they're called now, but there's these four posters about it's all right for us. To us it's a blip, like a pain in the neck, a data breach, but to other people it's like a lasting impact on them. And they've got these posters we looked at 2 weeks ago, which are great to remind us about the impact of data subjects of breaches. But this is the same thing, isn't it? So the company's gone bust, but everyone's data's still out there compromised.
I know. There's something I want to talk about today, actually. So going on to the main part of the session, the reason why we've decided to talk about this is because we've had a few cases recently, really, where it's been so relevant and so complicated that, it's something that definitely deserves its own session. We've, touched on ideas of controls and processes and due diligence and responsibilities over various episodes, but it's just so complex that it warrants its own one. So it's probably worth explaining briefly the difference between controls and processes on the face of it, and how it might come across as a simple concept, but we'll delve into it in a bit further detail, and maybe your minds will boggle as much as ours have in dealing with some of these cases. So Joe.
Oh, I knew that.
Smiling as if
you're
expecting.
I knew you're gonna nominate me. You know, always go
to. And then I saw the smile.
Waiting for it. Like, God, Joe, like, you tell everyone why we're here to talk about this.
Go on then.
So yes, as Jasmine says, over the past like 3 or 4 months, I've had quite a lot of cases that seem to come my way, with organisations just kind of struggling to determine the relationships of third parties that they're engaging with. And I think when I first came into data protection, I was under the misconception that it's fairly quite easy, and it can be quite easy to determine, the third party that you're engaged with, are they a processor or are they a controller? But there are some very nuanced cases where it is really quite difficult to do so. Hence why, as Jasmine says, that we've decided we're going to have a conversation. And I think the way that this is going to go, I think we've picked out, haven't we, several cases that we've come across recently at DPP, and just trying to explore and unpack them and try and together, as well as the listeners, to try and determine what party is, where they sit as a controller and a processor. So yeah, Jasmine, I think it's probably a good idea to say what a controller and a processor is.
Well, it looks simple enough, doesn't it? When you read the GDPR, it looks simple enough, doesn't it? A controller that determines the means of the purpose of the processing.
Yeah.
That should be straightforward enough. And a processor processes on behalf of a controller. That should be straightforward enough. But most of the relationships we come across, well, many of the relationships we come across, it's not that clear cut, is it? And that the relationship is that somebody's not only potentially contributing to the means and the purposes of the processing, but also actually undertaking processing on behalf of the controller. So sometimes, you've got this relationship and it's actually both, but for different, distinct processing purposes. Now, I was looking at writing up my audit report, Joe. I'm looking up the list of the register of processors. And on the register of processors, which was 179 organizations, there's things like cleaning company, carrying out the cleaning of customers' houses, a payroll processing organization, Age UK for providing information leaflets to customers, ABC Electricals to complete electricity testing, or Associated Garage Doors to carry repairs to garage doors. And I'm there thinking, how are these guys processes? What are they doing in terms of processing on behalf of the controller? Because to my mind, many of those, they'll be just processing for their own benefit, apart from the payroll operation.
Yeah. No, that's quite relevant to one that I was discussing earlier today. So we've got a customer who provide, you know, uniforms to organizations. So for organizations' staff, their customer staff. It's probably easier if we call this, you know, initial organization a certain name, but I won't say what the
workwear.
Actual name is.
It's like it's workwear, isn't it? They provide workwear for people.
We'll call them workwear.
All right, we'll call them.
We'll call them PPE Co. Then. No, we'll call them workwear. It's easier. So workwear provide workwear for organisations, for customers, staff, and it's on the face of it, you know, it might seem quite straightforward. There might not even be personal data there, but that's something that we'll get into in a minute. What's happened is that they have had a breach, a ransomware attack, I believe, where 40 gigabytes of data was extracted from one of their servers. The extracted data was encrypted, so they don't know what was taken, but you know, they can draw to some conclusions that certain types of information has been taken, such as their HR information, HR data, and potentially certain customers' data as well. But basically, whether they are a controller or processor, they have informed their customers of the breach and said, you know, this has happened. And one of them's come back to them and said, okay, well, are you the controller or are we? Who's reporting this breach? And it's raised a lot of questions, because so that this organization is a group and they have different entities within it that, you know, provide slightly different services, but all within the same remit. So that alone means that they have, you know, slightly different approaches to things. We're still getting to grips with exactly what that is. So there's, you know, we don't have all of the answers at the moment, but in for one of the entities, you know, they have a portal and their customers will order workwear off this or through this portal. And this is the situation with this customer who's come back and said, what's the relationship? So it might be the case that the organization, so the customer has, you know, they'll order the workwear on behalf of all of their staff. In some instances, you know, staff might order it directly for themselves, and it's determining what the relationship is there. So that's the first step to it. So what are your thoughts so far?
So essentially we've got DPP fleeces and polo shirts and hard hats and stuff like that. And so Megan would go on to the portal and say, I've got a new starter, Phil Brining, and these are his dimensions, if that's the right word. And he's entitled to three polos, your pair of chinos, two hard hats or whatever, yeah? So we're putting personal data from our employees onto this platform. Or it could be that we say to Joe, you know, if you want to order a new polo shirt, log on the platform, as long as it's not beyond your amount you're allowed to have, your quota, then just order one. And then they'll ship it where? To your home address, to a locker in a location, to the office? You know, don't know. But anyway, basically, there's personal data on this platform. And that is not only names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, but it's also sizes.
Yeah. Work ID as well. Things like that. So, yeah. Do you have anything else to add?
Your question is kind of like around who do you think is responsible for reporting. I think based on what you've said so far is that the failure has come from the processor, right? It's come from the organization who is providing the portal. So even though when it's a controller processor relationship, the controller is the one that's kind of liable for a processor, but because it's the failings of the processor security measures in terms of, you know, their servers have been hacked essentially, I think it would probably be the workwear's responsibility to kind of report that. I think at this moment, well, to the Information Commission Office, I guess.
Well, that's not what the GDPR says. It says it's responsibility of the controller to report a breach, responsibility of the process to report to the controller, isn't it? I would have thought that the the uniform supplier is a processor. They've only got hold of that data for the purposes of processing it on behalf of the controller. They wouldn't have it otherwise. They wouldn't have a list of employees anywhere other than their customers.
So this is where the part two comes into it. So the tricky thing is that sometimes just members of staff will order, use the portal directly, and they'll order their own uniform. So I would say in that instance, that would make Workwear a controller, because they've got that direct relationship with an individual. They're collecting that individual's data, unless there's something in contract to state, you know,
but only on behalf
we're
of
issuing
the- We're only on behalf of the bank or the airline or the train company or whoever, you know.
What if it's like a sole trader, maybe? I think there's nuances to it that means that in some instances, if the individual is directly, you know, if it's the responsibility of, maybe it might not be under the instruction of the controller, of the customer. It could be that, you know, if I start a DPP and I've got to buy my own uniform, which is the case in some places, here's how you can do it, then would you not say that that's the individual's responsibility to go out and purchase it, which makes the relationship
I don't think so.
I think there's still some like unanswered questions which makes it difficult, but the difficulty here is that there's so many different approaches depending on the customer and the customer's approach and the relationship with Workwear, is that, you know, it's not easily identified. And within that as well, there's minimal maybe, but in this case of the breach, there isn't a data processing or sharing agreement. There's nothing to specify who owns the responsibility, or, you know, determines the means and purposes, etc. So I think the fact that there's nothing specified there then mean that, you know, there's no responsibility, there's no instructions even to say, okay, you're going to retain this information for this period of time, which means that then Workwear has some decision to make over that, which then does that make them a controller, even if they weren't intended to be? Does that make them a controller?
I think it probably does, yeah. I think that they, through the lack of contract, have potentially slipped into being a controller.
It's very complicated. And one that I thought was worth raising on this, just to highlight, you know, it's a lot of times these questions arise based on something else, whether it's a breach or a subject access request. And, you know, it can open up a minefield. So it's something to just really be aware of and make sure that with any third party relationships you've got, to have some sort of onus and control over them and measures in place to make sure that, you know, these situations are avoided before they become an issue.
I don't want to be glib to Petra's comment here, but when would you not have a contract when you're 99.9% of UK organisations is what I would say. I think that the majority of the time we find, even when we're doing audits of, you know, pretty good organisations, we find that there's contracts missing, not in place. You know, so yeah. I think, agree with you and absolutely entirely, and I don't mean to be glib about it, but I think, you know, when would you not have a contract? You should have a contract. By not having a contract, you're exposing yourself to the risk of being designated as a controller, as I think we are in this case here. But...
yeah, it's like we say, you know, it's something that needs to be done beforehand, and I'm assuming that people listening into this, you know, that have enough awareness of data protection to put these.
Yes, of course.
Put these measures in place.
This is Shirley. Okay, when will you not have a contract? Would be, if you look at the typical definition of a contract, is when there's an exchange. What do you call it again? When there's...
consideration.
Consideration. So in the absence of consideration and two companies are working together, they can decide, we'll share this information. For instance, example, a housing association, for instance, processes information on behalf of a local authority and has local authority data, and then they tender for new contract but don't get this contract, another company gets it and they have to share this personal data with the other one. There's no need for a contract. You can move that information as under a data sharing agreement that's not contractual. But when I say contract, I'm looking at where consideration exists in the main contract, as part of the main contract, and then data sharing derives from it. So if it derives, it's a data processing based on controller processor relationship. Someone's doing something for someone else. But when they're equal, I'm just passing over maybe local authority data to you. We don't need a contract. It's not really a contractual contract, but it's an agreement to share data, and we're both controllers.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you at all. And you might find there's a memorandum of understanding, or you might be providing that information.
Okay, yeah, there might be an MOU,
You could be providing the information to the third party on the basis of the contract you've got with the first party. You know, right? You've come to the end of your contract. We now want you to pass that data over to somebody else. But you won't have a contract without anybody else. You're fulfilling your obligations as a processor. But I absolutely get what you mean. So there are instances where you don't need a contract. You know, a data sharing agreement or an MOU is sufficient for controller to controller type of relations. But I think we were probably thinking much more about processes where GDPR says you have to have a contract. So apologies if it was not clear. But you make some very good points. And I like the point about consideration, because that's always interesting, isn't it? Because you might have a commercial contract or even a non-commercial contract and a data protection or data processing agreement as part of that. But there's usually no consideration involved in the data processor agreement or addendum. It's usually a commercial contract that's got the consideration, and consideration may be financial, may be something other, but interesting, all interesting stuff to think about.
Yeah.
I think your point about this particular case is very interesting. I forgot what I was going to say. Now, people are saying about what about processors and sub-processors. But I mean, I was going to come back to your comment, Joe. According to Article 33, you know, it's the obligation of the controller to report the breach. You know, so, you know, the processor, you know, I don't think it should be. I think the controller should be made aware of it. The controller should be evaluating it. The controller should be making that call whether to report or not, and then notify the data subjects or not.
Yeah, I think my kind of justification kind of stemmed from that we're not actually sure whether they're a controller or a processor, and I was kind of probably not a good thing to do, but kind of thinking about, you know, like One Advanced, when they their failure of security led to a personal data breach, didn't it, because they failed to implement multi-factor authentication. You know, if you are a processor and you've discovered that and that's led to a personal data breach, and you've got, you know, thousands of controllers, I guess, are you expected to contact all of them for them to then contact the information commissioner's office?
Yeah.
The thing, yeah, it's a lot to do.
Yeah, one of the things, I see my name, I'll come back to this. If you see my name in a comment, that's always a bad thing. One of the things that I find as well, when you're looking at like a register of processors and this and the next thing, it's often too simplistic. You know, we've got Excel sheets or we've got whatever we've got. And, you know, if you've got a complex relationship, like, you know, in this particular one I was looking at, they've got BDO auditors, you know, right, okay, for the audit, according to the ICO, for the audit functions, they're more likely to be a controller than a processor. But if they're doing payroll, they're more likely to be a processor than a controller. And therefore, you know, it's the nuances are in what they are actually doing rather than who they actually are. And if it's a complex relationship, it could be that there's multiple processing activities, some of which may be a controller, some of which may be a joint controller, some of which may be a controller in common, and some of which may be a processor. And unfortunately, in reality, it's quite complicated. Now, reflecting that in our documentation, given the tools we're often using, I think is potentially the weak point.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think it's annoying. So when it comes to relationships, there's a lot of, you know, elements of data protection law that I can, if someone asks me a question, immediately I can think of an answer and know what's relevant. For example, the most appropriate lawful basis, that can come to me really quickly. When determining relationships, it doesn't, and that it bugs me, to be honest.
Right, let me put it
my brain can just explode sometimes.
Let me put a scenario to you then. Sorry, go on. Carry on. I'm interrupting you.
It's all right. It's all right. It's just more the fact that, you know, obviously, like you're saying, there are different elements to a relationship that might alter it, at least per process and activity. But then just establishing between joint controllers and independent controllers, there is a line that needs to be drawn, and sometimes establishing that line I struggle with, because there is an argument to say that there's a joint interest or purpose for a lot of processing activities, but then, you know, you've got to differentiate in certain ways. So that was it. Give me a scenario.
No, my scenario though, and I use this whenever I'm trying to get across the point, you know, this discussion about process controller and in training or whatever. So let's say that we're commissioning a company to do surveys, custom surveys for us. I'm only going to tell you that much. Processor or controller?
Processor.
Well,
it depends, I imagine, doesn't it?
Yeah. Processor if depends it's purely on. For that organisation, but then if they're then using research for their own purposes, then that would make them a controller. But I do feel like I'm missing another part.
No.
Gem,
so the,
yeah.
the next bit is, so let's say we say to them, right, these are the data subjects we want you to go and survey. These are the questions we want you to ask. And this is what we expect back in our report. That's quite distinct instructions.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we say to them, go out and find a data subject, formulate the questions, we're broadly wanting this kind of stuff back. We're not really bothered how you analyze it, you know, but we want some analysis back. You know, what does that make them more of a controller? They're selecting the data subjects, they're determining, you know, not necessarily the purpose of the processing, although they might be, you know, they might be deciding, well, we'll ask these types of questions because it's a lifestyle survey and we know the client wants back, you know, some lifestyle-based information. Now, they could well be much more. I think it's a spectrum, you see. I think they're much more at the controller end of the spectrum then. So at one end of the spectrum, we've got HMRC. We provide employee data to HMRC. They're a controller. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got email companies sending emails on your behalf or a SaaS platform. Mostly a processor. You can find some examples right at the other end of the spectrum. But then, you know, in the middle between the two, you've got different potentials depending on the nuances of what is actually happening on the ground with the processing. Now, if they then retain that data, as you quite rightly say, Joe, for doing long-term research or something else for their own benefit, or reselling that research, well, they're definitely controlled for that aspect of it. But this is a complex, on the face of it, a simple, but actually potentially a really complex relationship.
Yeah, you sound a little bit robotic. I don't know if it's because your mic slipped from your mouth, or I don't know if everyone else is picking up on that. But
that must have been my headache. I'm feeling
no, that's, robotic. No, that's better. It must have been that.
Malfunction.
Yeah, malfunction.
Yeah, I mean... I'd still struggle to, unless they use it. I think if an organization is commissioning a, you know, research project and they've asked the survey company to go out and do what they think's best within that, I still would sway to the side of processor, because the processor, say in an example where the commissioner doesn't really know how to go about it. They know what they want, but they don't know, you know, how to put that into practice. But, you know, it's the survey company's experience and it's their bag, basically. Then, you know, they can rely on them for that. I don't think then that makes them
controller. But they're letting the survey organisation determine the means and the purpose of the processing by determining what data is collected, how they do it, and what's returned.
I use it as a training example is because it sparks this kind of discussion, and it makes people usually think about, does he have a point or doesn't he have a point?
I think it depends on what the commissioning organisation want from it. If they know what results they want from it, and then they're happy for the survey company to establish that, then I think the commissioning company is the controller.
Carry on.
At what level? I don't even know if this is part of the argument, but in this instance, but you know, a processor was, you know, the commissioning a processor in any instance to provide a service for them to and in part of that, you know, they have to make some decisions themselves on how they do that. It's for the controller to determine what they want and then the processor to put that into practice, I would say, in some instances. Obviously, you know, don't quote me on that. There are levels to it that's probably, there's no point going into such detail on, but just so you get the essence of my argument, I still struggle to understand how the survey company is a controller if they're not, if the outcome isn't, you know, any within their control, it in terms of how they handle that information, why they want it, why they need it, it's still ups the controller. They're still going to take that research and provide it back to the controller. Here's the findings. We're not using this for anything else. So there you go. You know, onto the next one.
Yeah, so you're saying a processor can determine means and purpose of processing around things like maybe like retention, for example, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a controller.
No, not retention, probably the least retention.
The only reason I said that is because it sparked something that is a work I've been doing, doing a DPIA on external attack surface mapping services for one of our customers. And the organization that does the scanning and the external attack surface mapping is a processor and the customer is a controller. And the controller, the organization, you know, determines the duration of the process and the purpose, the data types and why. But then the organization determines the retention periods. But that doesn't mean that the organization that's providing the service is a controller. They're still a processor. So I was just trying to back up your argument a little bit. But I don't know if I've done that very well.
It's just confusing.
It is confusing, and that's why we wanted to have this session.
Yeah.
It's not easy, and I've racked my brains multiple times over the past couple of months trying to wrap my head around whether an organisation is a controller or a processor. And we're not necessarily here to give answers, are we, either? We're just kind of kicking ideas around, having a bit of a chat and trying
I'm just having a quick look at the ICO's website. I was looking for the bit where they say about why accountants are controllers, not processors, but I've actually found they've got an example of market research, and it says that in this scenario painted by the ICO, the market research company is a joint controller, because we have to read it on the ICO's website, but I mean, it's quite interesting because this
will
is why
you read it, because I want to know the answer.
A bank contract, here we go again. Shall I do a quiz? A bank contracts a market research company to carry out some research. The bank's brief specifies its budget and that it requires a satisfaction survey of its main retail services based on the views of a sample of customers across the UK. The bank leaves it to the research company to determine sample size, interview methods, and presentation results. The research company is posting personal data on the bank's behalf, but it is also determining the information that is collected, what to ask the bank's customers, and the manner in which the processing, the survey, will be carried out. It has the freedom to decide such matters as to which customers to select for interview, what form the interview should take, what information to collect from the customers, and how to present the results. This means the market research company is a joint controller with the bank regarding the processing of personal data to carry out the survey, even though the bank retains overall control of the data because it commissions the research and determines the purpose the data will be used for. I'll put a link in there because I read that very quickly. I will not get a job on Jack and Ori.
Okay, it does make sense. I mean, you know, they are determining the means and purposes, but I think where my head spins is the level at which, you know, you determine, okay, you have this much control over how this process and activity will play out. Because I remember reading in the European Data Protection Board guidance, it can be differentiated between non-essential means and essential means, which I understand the concept of, but it again, where do you draw that line? And in playing devil's advocate, is there an argument to say that you can play, you can be a processor even when having, I don't know, you know, determining factors within a processing activity?
Was that a question?
No, just
just the ramblings of a Jasmine.
I'm just thinking it out loud. Sorry for tagging you.
No, it's all right. I've got a scenario, but I don't really know kind of, not a case, sorry. Am I okay to provide and throw another one in
you
there?
Can, just to... I was going to can't find it, but I was going to, so paraphrase, I think the ICO says that an accountant is more likely to be a controller because it's using its professional skill and judgment and will have certain rules like, you know, anti-fraud rules, where it will process data for that purpose, irrespective of the instructions of its client. So I wondered how far you can stretch that. You know, I wondered if, you know, so when we're handling a subject tax request for a customer, you know, we are exercising skill and we're using our knowledge. You know, does that make us a joint controller or does that make us a processor?
I think we're a processor. Again,
rhetorical question, maybe something to mull over.
Yeah, I mean, because we're acting under the instruction, but we're also doing what the ICA guidance
says.
Well,
we're reviewing
it to be a
controller. The data, and we're determining, and this is a reference for a third party in our view. You know, this is something that's exempt from disclosure. Therefore, we're going to suggest it's redacted. Ultimately, the client will make the call, but
yeah.
When we're actually doing that processing, are we acting in the capacity of a joint controller helping to, you know, joint the reach objective?
I think so, yeah.
Right, anyway, okay, well, that was a quick one.
Sorry, I have this the phone calling through my headphones again, so it's quite distracting.
Anyway, I've got a case that it's, I guess, similar, but maybe a little bit easier to determine. So mine's to do with solicitors and where they kind of sit in relation to an organisation. So a few months back, I got contacted by one of our customers where there was a breach. So a housing association has been involved in an antisocial behaviour case at the courts, who was supported by the housing association's third party solicitors. The housing association provided solicitors with information relating to the case, who then decided to share personal information to the defendant that included diary notes of the ASB case. The HA received a complaint from the data subject, having heard from a neighbour that their personal information had been disclosed without any prior authorisation to the defendant. The housing association contacted the data subject to inform them that the solicitors are the entity responsible for the personal data breach, and they are the data controller in their own right, who made the decision to disclose the information to the defendant. The data subject has since complained again, stating they have received legal advice saying that the housing association and the solicitors are joint controllers, explaining further that because the housing association contacted the solicitors and the data subject did not, the housing association would deal with the data breach, and the data subject will not be engaging with the housing association's contractor on the issue.
Well,
does that make
it does make sense. Well, I think, yeah, there's a bit to unpack, but this is the point which I think trying to make is that the housing association and the solicitors might well be joint controllers for the purpose of presenting a case to the courts, but the disclosure of that information was, if it was done without the knowledge and authority of the housing association, then surely that positions the law firm as the controller responsible for that. You know, so you know, and that's the thing, isn't it? You've got to break down what is going on into its constituent parts, and that disclosure is a discrete processing activity.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, shall I tell you what my conclusion was?
Oh yes, please.
So I said that I said the solicitor receives the personal data for the purpose of taking it to the court in order to support the claimant. The solicitor assumes the role of a data controller, and I went and did some digging around kind of like solicitor regulation authority. So solicitors are deemed as independent controllers, as the SRA Code of Conduct for Solicitors provides a professional obligation for solicitors to take responsibility for the personal data they process. Specifically, paragraph 6.3 of the code sets out a requirement for solicitors to keep the affairs of clients confidential unless the disclosure is required or permitted by law or the client consents. So instead of exploring this further, the SRA have provided guidance on this, stating that the courts have stated that the duty to preserve confidentiality is unqualified, in that it is a duty to keep the information confidential, not merely to take all reasonable steps to do so. It is not limited to the duty not to communicate the information to a third party. It is a wider duty not to misuse it. So I said, with these professional obligations in mind, and considering that the solicitor determined independently, you know, what data shared by that the housing association should be used at the courts, the lawful basis for the process of data, and how long to process the data for, I was under the assumption that the solicitor was an independent controller, and they were the ones responsible for the breach.
Yeah, but do you think that whole kind of they've got a duty of confidentiality, it sounds really woolly to me. It sounds like almost that's being concocted because the legal pressure said, oh, come off it, we're not signing all these process agreements with people, you know, just class us as joint controllers and we're fine. It just sounds really flaky when you, yeah, you know, where do you draw the line with these kind of relationships?
Yeah, I was thinking about this yesterday. Like, can you choose what relationship you have with an organization? Because I've seen it before where two parties will be discussing and they almost, you know, choose to establish how the relationship will play out. And sometimes that is after, you know, the services have already commenced and whatnot. But I think beforehand, there are some instances, you know, you can actually, in some instances, you can decide how you want to play it out, whether you want one organisation to act as a controller or not. Sorry, and a processor.
Yeah, it's all, I think, borne out in the actual what happens on the ground, nuts and bolts, doesn't it? So you can say, oh, I'm going to be a this, that, and the next thing and write it into a contract. But if you then are proven to be, you know, jointly or independently determining the means of purpose of the process, and the ICO's view is, well, it don't matter what your contract says. The reality of what you're doing is what talks loudest.
Yeah. Goes back to follow the data and not the contract sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, yeah. the other thing is, it gets much more complicated when you've got cross-border, you know, restricted transfers going on, and you're trying to figure out, you know, how those work, or you've got a big conglomerate and you've got, you know, some kind of overseas offices, you know, that are either part of the same legal entity or separate legal companies, you know, but wholly owned by the same group. These are, again, some of the really complicated arrangements that we come across, as why you've asked for this topic to be on the podcast, Joe, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, did we want to unpack that? I mean, in terms of the international transfer side of things,
potentially,
there's only 5 minutes left.
I was working on something earlier in the year with Vicky when she was working with us, and there was a company that contracted out their HR screening processes to a firm, a British company, to a firm in South Africa. So people apply to ABC Limited, and XYZ in South Africa review the CV, interview the candidate, and decide whether they are suitable for the role. If they are, then they put them forward to ABC Limited, who then subcontract them into National Health Service organisations. And you know, that was like, well, what's going on here then? So it was, you know, it was quite complicated, because, you know, the organization XYZ doing the screening, you know, they are determining which candidates are successful or not. You know, are they acting as a processor? Are they acting as a controller? Are they doing a bit of both? You know, it's and then, you know, what about then supply? So they then supply these candidates into the NHS, and they get paid through ABC's portal, through the you know, the company that's our client, that's providing the human resources into the NHS service. And that is, you know, that took us a while to draw that up in terms of what's going on in terms of data flows and decision making, and then overlay the international dimension on top of it. And it took us a little bit of time to figure it out as to what was going on. And only when you've drawn it up, I mean, you have to draw it. Here it is, like drawing as a flowchart. You've got to draw it out, I think, to be able to actually interrogate it properly and get your head around it.
To visualize it, really.
Yes, yeah, so that's the first thing I do when people start talking about these styles. I start drawing stick men and factories, and or stick people and factories, and, you know,
yeah,
drawing data flows.
It does help, doesn't it? I'm sat here thinking, as you've kind of both of you been explaining things, I'd love to see a diet. I'm slowly morphing into you, Phil. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, but
it's not a good thing.
No, I didn't think it was, but diagrams really do help kind of bring things to life, don't they? And there's been times throughout the session today where you've been explaining stuff, and I'm like, I've no idea what you're talking about, because I just can't
no,
picture,
you need to picture it. You need to visualize it. Yeah, absolutely, quite right.
Now, before we finish, I thought it might be worth talking about the advanced provisional fine a couple of months ago that the ICO issued for $6 million, because it's the first, as far as I'm aware, the first fine. I mean, I think it is provisional. It could be changed, but first fine towards a data processor under the GDPR to date. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Correct, you're quite right.
Yeah. And I think it's really important in highlighting that, you know, processors, while they might have less responsibilities than controllers, it is still recognised, and, you know, they can be held liable for non-compliance, especially around security measures and things that are deemed, you know, reasonable in with regard to their responsibilities to have some responsibility over, I suppose, or bonus in comparison.
But just remind
to a controller.
Me, Jasmine, that was they were providing services to NHS.
I think software.
Software as a service, yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a breach. They had medical information there. There was a breach.
Attack.
Yeah. And and the ICO said, well, they didn't say, look, health service organisations, you should have made sure that this company had sound controls in place, given the nature of the context of the data you were asking to process on your behalf, they said, look, processor, you should have ensured you had decent quality provisions in
multi-factor
place.
Multi-factor authentication, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, maybe because it was so obvious, MFA, maybe because it was so obvious that, you know, you should have had that in place. But I'm interested that they didn't say to the controllers, why didn't you check this lot was in place?
But that's the thing, though. If an organisation say these things are in place and, you know, you've been shown evidence and then a month down the line, something fails. I think it was only one account, I think, that didn't have it on. And that's just what happened. You know, what can a controller do? You know, if you've carried out your due diligence, okay, this organization implements multi-factor authentication on its platform. We've seen it. It's effective. It looks great. A month down the line, it's failed. I'm not really sure what a controller can do about that.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Joe, because I like probing the wording of Article 28. You know, when the processing is carried out by on behalf of a controller, the controller shall use only process providing sufficient guarantees to implement appropriate technical and organizational measures. So if I say I promise you, Joe, I'll put all that in place, is that a sufficient guarantee? You know, why do we bang on about due diligence? You know, why do we need to verify these controls are in place? Do we need to? You know, are we over-egging it? Well, at the end of the day, I suppose it's our reputation that is solid if there is a problem. So yes, we want to check, but GDPR is quite vague again and high level in its wording.
And a lot of stuff.
I agree with that, but yeah. But in this case, you know, it's NHS data. It's so sensitive that, you know, the NHS, it's their duty to ensure that organisation, and I don't mean in this case, to be fair, because if it is, you know, it was clearly more the fault of Advance. But for example, it is their outright responsibility to make sure that they are confident that any processes they engage with have sufficient measures in place, you know, the top standard. It's gold standard, really. I'm not sure about advanced their you know, general measures, but obviously in this case it's failed, and it's down to them because it's something that's well within the expectation that they have in place. But yeah, it's I think it does depend on the data in question, in terms of what extent you go to for due diligence.
That's very nice summed up, Jasmine.
Oh, yeah, it's half one. On that note, we'll call it there. We will be back next week for a GDPR radio session. But in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, Phil and Joe, for your contributions as well. And have a great weekend.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.